Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show that explores the people, the stories, and the events of Central Iowa. We're your hosts today, Greta Anderson and
Stephanie Schubert.
Well, Stephanie, if there's been one major event in Central Iowa this past spring, it's been a precipitation event.
Severe thunderstorms.
Followed by smaller rain events.
Downpours, drizzles.
And the occasional mist.
Quite a variety, wouldn't you say?
Buckets of rain, buckets of tears. Got all them buckets coming out of my ears. Buckets of moonbeams.
Well, this week's event ties into one of my personal passions, the beautiful Iowa soil. Later, we speak with a Soil and Water Conservation District conservationist, and in fact, my first volunteer experience was with a Soil and Water Conservation District.
Yes, I just learned this about you, and I feel privileged to tag along on these interviews because I have lived in Iowa my whole life, and I am a little embarrassed to say that I just learned what a watershed means.
Okay, then, my youthful protege, what is a watershed?
Okay, so a watershed is a piece of land that drains into a body of water. Yes?
Yes. Yes. Actually, Stephanie, along the way this past week, I've really become enamored of the gallery of beautiful words that the experts I talked to were using. I don't think the experts even know the words are beautiful.
Like watershed?
Right. And aquifer? Aquifer is my new favorite word.
Well, you've got the water in there, the aqua part. What's the fur for?
The Latin root fur means carry, as in fairy.
So that's why an aquifer is the underground structure that carries water.
Yeah, and there are different types of aquifers. And we in Ames and most of the surrounding areas get our water from alluvial aquifers.
Alluvial.
Isn't it beautiful? Now, what do you suppose the water in an alluvial aquifer sounds like?
Maybe something like this.
That's nice. Alluvial comes from the word alluvium, which is sediment and gravel deposited by flowing water, as in a riverbed. Here's the director of the Ames Water Plant, John Dunn, describing our aquifer and how it's been recharged by this rain.
So recharge is a term you use for replenish.
Right. You charge a battery, but nature recharges an aquifer. I just love that. Anyway, here's John Dunn, the director of the City of Ames Water and Pollution Control Department. And you'll have to excuse me, Stephanie. I asked a ton of questions about this aquifer. We've had a lot of water, and water is a good thing in many situations. Speak from the perspective of being director of the water plant. What do you think of all this rain?
Well, you know, about 10 months ago, we were talking about an opposite phenomenon. We were in the midst of a relatively severe drought, and with the Ames Water Plant pulling 100% of its water from groundwater sources from an alluvial aquifer, the drought was having a significant impact on the availability of water, and it was also occurring at the same time when the highest demands from our customers are coming during that dry weather. We do have an alluvial aquifer here in Ames, which means it's an old gravel-filled river channel, a pre-glacial river channel that we're actually pulling the water from. And there is a strong hydraulic connection between the rivers and the aquifers. And what we saw last summer and into the early fall was the aquifer levels dropping rather dramatically at a rate of about a half a foot to a foot per day. Contrasting that with what we've seen over the last week, we saw the groundwater levels in our potable supply wells actually climb about 10 feet in the last 7 days. So there's been a substantial recovery in the aquifer formation, and the near flood conditions that we saw this week have essentially wiped out any negative impacts of the drought that we saw last summer.
I had heard somewhere that it was going to take us 3 years to get back to a normal level of water in our systems, in our groundwater levels. it's only taken 6 months. What's that about?
Yeah, different types of aquifer formations will respond differently. Having such a shallow aquifer in the Ames area that does have that strong connection to a river, on the negative side, it means in a drought situation, we see the response of the drought much quicker in the aquifer. On the other hand, coming out of a drought situation, it means that we can recover much quicker. And that would be as opposed to a much deeper aquifer, say the Jordan Aquifer here in the Ames area that's a couple thousand feet deep. That type of an aquifer is much slower to show the impacts of a drought, but it's also much slower in recovering from a drought also.
Okay, so we broadcast from Story City, and if you can imagine a concentric circle around Story City, the water co-ops and municipalities in that range of area extending down south of Ames, almost to Ankeny, typically, where do they get their water?
Generally in Iowa, smaller utilities will draw water from a groundwater supply, similar to what Ames does. There's a certain size above which wells start to become inefficient, and so you start to become dependent on surface water supplies. For example, the Des Moines Water Works, I know that their main drinking water plant is pulling water from both the Des Moines River and the Skunk River, but they also do have a smaller satellite facility out on the west side of town that is pulling some water from groundwater sources as well. So they're actually blending a source of water.
So are there a lot of these alluvial channels throughout Iowa?
It actually varies pretty wildly depending on what part of the state you're in. We happen to be in an area that has an aquifer formation that is relatively plentiful and is also of fairly high quality too, because that's the other concern when you start looking at drinking water and the sources of water is what's the quality of the water, what contaminants might be in there that would need to be removed before the water would be safe to drink. And fortunately here in the Ames area, we're blessed with a high quality aquifer source.
Elsewhere in Iowa, what's the situation?
Well, I know, for example, now speaking about the drought, that northwestern Iowa was hit much harder by that. And that also is some areas where those shallow, readily available aquifer sources just are not plentiful. And so a lot of those areas are more dependent on, say, a rural water source to bring drinking water from a longer distance away to provide their needs. You know, the deeper aquifers are there. A lot of times those deeper aquifers, though, sometimes will come with some other constituents in the water that make it a little more difficult to treat. Just speaking generally, you may have issues with things like radon in the water or things like that that would just require some additional treatment that would be a little more expensive to be able to produce water from those sources.
Well, just to follow up, do any municipalities, they'll get their water from the Jordan Aquifer?
Oh, I know that there are a number that do. There are some who in recent years I know have been trying to move off of the Jordan or try to use the Jordan maybe as more of a backup source or a peak source just during those high demand times of the summer.
Okay, and the Jordan would be comparable to maybe the Oglala, which is very well known.
Yeah, that's correct. It's a deeper aquifer. It's a confined aquifer, which means that water cannot move into it directly from the surface, at least not right in the immediate area.
And it's confined by limestone, right?
Limestone or some other layer that prevents water from moving down directly from the surface.
But what's on top of the gravel beds that form our alluvial aquifer, is that just soil or
Yeah, what you would find is, particularly if you get close to the rivers down into the floodplain in the Ames area, is you might have about 8 to 10 feet of good black Iowa topsoil. And once you get below that, you're right down into sand and gravel layers. That's why you tend to find the proliferation of gravel quarries right next to the river, because those stone sources are so readily available right near the surface.
Mm-hmm. So I've heard of the Oglala Aquifer. That's the huge one in the High Plains states centered in Nebraska. Isn't it drying up?
Yeah, that's the big issue. The Oglala Aquifer is drying up. And so is the Jordan. The Jordan is the one that I compared to the Oglala with my newfound information. And John mentioned concerns about the contaminants that the deeper aquifers contain, but there have also been concerns that our state's ethanol industry, with its high demand for water, is causing the Jordan aquifer levels to drop. The aquifer covers a large part of the state of Iowa.
And we're about to put a brand new ethanol plant in our area.
Yes, but according to the City of Nevada Administrator Elizabeth Hansen, that cellulosic ethanol plant will be drawing water from an alluvial aquifer, too. It sounds like the same alluvial aquifer that Ames uses.
So what they're really needing was a raw water well of 1 million gallons a day.
But where is that 1 million?
1 million is raw water, and so we have to dig a new well just dedicated to them.
So the City of Nevada is digging this well?
Correct.
And what kind of aquifer or what aquifer does it come from?
The aquifer is out next to 35, and we have some property on the east side of 35. It's closer to the Ames community, but that is the same aquifer that we use. It's a alluvial, is my understanding, aquifer out there. We have 5 wells currently in that location.
Alluvial.
Yes, I think Elizabeth was learning this word too. I think it's an important word.
Yes. Wow, 1 million gallons a day.
I know. I thought that sounded like a lot, but Elizabeth said the Nevada engineers weren't worried. And when I talked to the Ames water guys, they didn't seem to be too worried either. Nevada has 5 wells already. Ames has 22, so really, what's another well?
My head's swimming with all this information.
Time for a musical break?
Sure.
Well, this is Local Talk, and we are talking about aquifers, glacial till, the topography of our landscape, as well as the rainiest spring on record.
Closer to the poles of the earth you go, or ascend heights the temperature turns low. 10,000 years ago, the world was colder than it is today, Britain immersed in snow. Glaciation changed the face of the countryside to become more like the earth we know. Working slowly, giant hunks of ice cut and slice, then push aside turf and stone. Signs say at the time of the ice age, a third of the earth's surface totally snowed over. Then the Fahrenheit rose, polar caps and ice flows capsized and shrank in size loads. Today the only glaciers remain on high latitude or low altitude terrain. So though only a tenth of the globe's glaciated, there's occasional formations close to the equator. See the way that they're made in this how-to guide.
So I'm just beginning to get what John Dunn said about our aquifer being pre-glacial. It connects to the other information we heard about the Des Moines Lobe.
Yeah, so for those of you just joining us, Ames gets its water from an alluvial aquifer, just 100 or 200 feet down. That's relatively shallow. This alluvial aquifer is actually a riverbed from the pre-glacial era. Then, about 12,000 years ago, the glaciers came and dumped a lot of sediment on top of them.
And this glacial sediment is one of the things that makes our landscape rather unique, especially when it comes to water flow.
Right. Let's listen to Clay Pierce. He's the one who taught us about the Des Moines Lobe. He's a research scientist for the U.S. Geological Survey, and he'll describe what it means for us to be part of the Des Moines Lobe, which is one of the newest places in North America.
So we're in an area called the Des Moines Lobe, kind of an oblong geological region that extends from up in Minnesota and the Dakotas down in this sort of a lobe-like kind of finger projection that goes about as far south as Des Moines. And it runs up from about Des Moines up through kind of north central and into northwestern Iowa and then further north. And it's an area called the Prairie Pothole Region. that has very fairly flat topography and lots of depressions that are left over from when the last major glacial period receded. And so kind of a mix of depressions where chunks of ice melted and formed large lakes and ponds and wet areas as the glacier was receding. Geologically, it's considered relatively young, so there hasn't been a lot of time, say, compared to southern Iowa, places like Missouri, where there's been many, many more thousands of years of time for streams to cut down and to make well-defined valleys and ravines for the stream network to channel through. Our landscape is much newer. The streams are much more recent. And in fact, some of them are very recent. Some of the streams in this area are actually artificial. They were created in the late 1800s and early 1900s specifically to drain large, kind of low, wet areas that were kind of a lake, kind of a marsh, kind of just a wet prairie area that weren't easy to travel through, weren't easy to farm. And so when the European settlers came to this area in, I guess, the latter half of the 1800s, they were trying to establish a living, find places to live and to farm. And they gradually learned how to sort of tame this landscape by draining it and creating farms. And it's wonderful farmland, but its natural land cover was more of a wet, marshy area. In fact, the area right around Ames, I don't remember the exact quotes, but there are some pretty negative descriptions of the area right around Ames by the early settlers of how difficult it was and how wet and, you know, how mosquito-infested it was at times of the year. It wasn't the easiest place in Iowa, I guess, to settle, but they got that figured out, and so we now have a landscape that's very different from what first came. And so hydrologically, that original landscape, and especially through the prairie pothole area, was very retentive. Rains would fall, and there would be heavy rains like we have now, periods of heavy rain, and that water would just more or less collect in place. The prairie vegetation, the root structure, and just the thick vegetation and the depressions the way they were, and the lack of deep natural channels to drain that water away, just made the landscape essentially like a natural sponge, and that water would just sit and sit and sit. And the water, the descriptions from those periods of time talked about pretty clear water, heavily vegetated, but clear water. And, you know, a few natural streams going through, of course, but very retentive of water. And today, with all of that prairie landscape removed, those wetlands drained, artificial channels built to drain the water out of there, and then finally the underground or subsurface tiles that have been put in and continue to be put in, we're putting more and more of those in all the time. And that just gets that water out of there very quickly. So it results in the flow in a river, say like the Skunk River or the Des Moines River, being much more flashy. When it rains, that water level comes up really fast, and then it goes down really fast. It's a very different system than we had 200 years ago. We wouldn't have had the large magnitudes of floods. You know, floods certainly occurred, but probably not the frequency and magnitude that they have today.
Raindrops keep falling on my head, but that doesn't mean my eyes will soon be turning red. The cry is not for me, 'cause I'm never gonna stop the rain by complaining, because I'm free. Nothing's worrying me.
You're listening to KHOI Community Radio. The topic is water. We're your hosts, Stephanie Schubert and Greta Anderson. Well, Stephanie, it's some kind of comfort, I guess, to know that the area known as the Des Moines Lobe, where we live, used to be a marshland.
I was amazed to hear Clay say that 75% of our issues with flooding and drought are due to the structure of the land.
Yeah, unfortunately we didn't have our microphone on right then, did we?
No.
He was also sharing some very interesting information about beavers altering our landscape as well. But, I mean, alterations aside, we have had a pretty darn rainy spring. Yeah, it's been the rainiest spring on record, literally. More than 17 inches in Iowa from March through May.
How were they dealing with that in Ames? Were they afraid it would flood the city like it did in 2010?
Yeah, well, that's one of the things I asked John Dunn about, the man who introduced me to our aquifer. At the city of Ames, they have rainfall gauges, they have stream level gauges, and then they have a computer program that puts it all together, that models the water distribution and estimates where the water levels will be. And then they work in collaboration with Iowa State University, which monitors Squaw Creek, and the National Weather Service, and they get into chat rooms with the National Weather Service. They were doing this around the clock from mid-Memorial Day weekend through the whole week afterwards.
24 hours?
Yeah, 24-hour monitoring. They were, I said I wanted to come by on Friday to interview them. They were like, how soon can you come? We need to go to bed. So I managed to get by, and evidently the water crested Friday morning, right before I spoke with them, and then it was on its way down, and there was at least one day of dryness predicted, so they could go home and get a good night's sleep.
So what else did John Dunn have to say?
Well, I asked him about the water quality, how the heavy rain affects our water quality. And here's what he said. You've mentioned contaminants in the water, and you are the director of the Water and Pollution Control Department. Are there concerns with the excessive rainfall that we've had in relation to pollution?
Well, I'll speak first specifically to the Water Pollution Control Plant for Ames. The challenge that it sees during wet weather, like what we've been experiencing the last few weeks, is from clear water or rainwater getting into the sanitary sewer system and increasing the flow of water that comes to the treatment plant. So it becomes really just a capacity issue at the treatment facility. Speaking more generally about what happens to water quality in the rivers as a result of floods, floods are pretty indiscriminate as to what they would carry with them as they move into the river basins. As water comes off of parking lots or paved areas in urban surfaces, you know, it'll pick up gas, oil, you know, anything that would fall on a parking lot is likely going to run into the river. I know that there's been this phenomenon in Iowa over the last probably about 3 weeks. As the rains has finally started after this extended drought, that a lot of the utilities in the state that depend on surface water, rivers, for their drinking water source, is that they've seen a pretty significant spike in nitrates in the river. A lot of possible sources for that, but the impact on drinking water is that high nitrate levels start to become a health concern for young infants or for nursing mothers. And there have been a number of utilities around the state who have been watching nitrate numbers very closely the last 2 weeks.
By the time the water gets to the groundwater level into our aquifers, is it fairly well filtered?
Yeah, that's one of the advantages we have of the aquifer formation is that we have about 100 feet deep bed of a sand filter that the water goes through before it reaches us. And we have, over the years, we've monitored nitrate levels in the rivers in Ames, and we've also monitored nitrate in the groundwater source that we actually use for drinking water. And what we've seen are the nitrate levels in the river will seasonally go up and down through a very wide swing, and yet the nitrates in the drinking water coming out of the wells is very consistently not there. I don't know that we have ever detected the presence of nitrate in the drinking water.
I'm free, nothing's worrying me.
nitrates? Tiny nitrogen bits?
I think it's nitrogen with a few oxygens added to it, technically. But yes, John was quite diplomatic, saying that nitrates had many sources. The main source of nitrates in our rivers is fertilizers. And yes, we do have some lawn fertilizers in this part of the world. Most of that is agricultural. I even found that it's fairly common practice for farmers to put down fertilizer on bare ground before planting.
Oh, so it all washed away.
Well, they all say the fertilizer sticks to the soil. But if the soil itself is running off, yeah, that's an issue.
Soil runoff was the main issue with the other guest you and I visited with, Dana Holland.
Yep. Dana is the district conservationist for the Storey County Soil and Water Conservation District.
He's also the conservationist for Marshall County, just east of us.
I guess they're having to double up these days. But yeah, that was really kind of neat. I mean, in the morning we talked to Clay Pierce and found out about the Des Moines Lobe, which stretches down into central Iowa. And then we go to Dana's office, and the first thing he's talking about is how different Marshall County is from Storey County. Marshall County being hilly and outside the Des Moines Lobe, and Storey County being flat but poorly drained because it's so young and inside the Des Moines Lobe.
Dana had just been driving around in the county.
Yep, in the rain. He was not in a good mood, but he was obliging to us. So we'll let our listeners hear his plight. So we're here with Dana Holland, a district conservationist for the NRCS, Natural Resources Conservation Service. We're in the Soil and Water Conservation District office in Storey County, and we're going to talk about rain.
Yeah.
Dana, you were just out in the field looking things over. What did you see?
Well, it's pretty extensive damage here in Storey County. There's a lot of poorly drained ground here in the county, and there's a lot of fields that are still, the potholes still have a lot of water in them, and it all adds up to a lot of crop damage and crops that aren't being planted and aren't growing. All these little areas add up to reduce the amount of acres under row crop. What's happened this May is unprecedented so far. I guess it's the worst rainfall we've ever had in recorded history. So, it's not pretty at all. Of course, there's a lot of obvious erosion issues. Fortunately, you know, there's not been a lot of major catastrophes with flooding on the rivers. Obviously, a lot of crops washed out and drowned out, but...
So as a district conservationist, what do you see your job as in relation to this situation?
Well, it's an education thing to show people that we need to be prepared for these types of things. Living in Iowa in the Midwest, you're always going to have extreme weather events, whether it's drought or, you know, heavy rains. It seems to be a pattern. It seems like this is what we're going to have to deal with. You know, what's done is done now, but this is something we can show and educate people that, gosh, we need to be prepared, do what we can do to protect the soil.
What types of things are those? Preventative measures?
Yeah, well, the obvious one is we can reduce the amount of tillage we're doing. You know, we can put in our crops with these modern equipment without doing a lot of tillage, I think. Of course, I can sit here and say that. I'm not a farmer. I haven't put in crops, but I got a lot of good producers that have a track record of doing this, and they can do it this way, and I know a lot of other folks can too. We can put in a lot of grass waterways, grass buffers. Those types of things can be done.
Okay, so I drive around and I see little mini rivers kind of passing through the farm fields, and it might be on one side of my road, and on the other side of the road, you can see where it was a natural sort of little rivulet. And now every year you see the same pattern of flooding. Is that a type of place where you would recommend putting a grass waterway?
Well, it certainly could be. Those are signs of, you know, concentrated flow, and those are areas where we like to see grassy waterways, and they show themselves after rain events like this. The soil's saturated, the water has no place to go but across the land. So a lot of these areas self-identify, no doubt.
I saw a sign out in your lobby that says, your worst cropland is your best CRP land.
Yeah, this presents an opportunity to enroll in a conservation program like CRP, Conservation Reserve Program. There are options for buffers and grassed waterways. They can be put in the CRP, and of course the landowner can get an annual payment for that in addition to cost share to establish it. So, you know, what perfect timing. We have a sign-up going on right now, and after what's happened this May, there's a lot of places with marginal soil, with places the producer's always fighting to put in crops. These are great places for CRP, and I want to mention, too, that the rental rates are a lot better now. They're much more competitive with the cropping, so I would encourage all the landowners out there who have some interest to consider enrolling some ground in CRP, especially those marginal areas that are tough to farm and always seem to suffer from damage after these big storm events. So
it's kind of hard, though, to do a pothole, because those just appear right in the middle of a field and they're just kind of a round area.
Yeah, that's right. There's potholes galore here in Story County and all of north central Iowa. But there is a CRP option to enroll those areas, target those areas and put them in CRP. So you don't have to worry about trying to maintain drainage in those areas, trying to harvest or plant a crop. They can be targeted and mapped out and put in CRP. It's definitely an opportunity now.
What kind of grasses are put in? Are they always prairie or any kind of grass?
Landowners has options. They can go with prairie grasses, and you know, that's certainly preferred maybe for wildlife types of things. They're also very deep-rooted. They can sequester nutrients. More erosion-prone areas, it might be better to do the cool-season grasses that are denser, maybe to try to hold the soil in place better. Of course, they have a wildlife value too, but there's even tree and shrub planting options too.
And do they come to your office to talk about that?
Come to NRCS and FSA. We both work together with CRP. FSA administers the program. We help write the conservation plans and the seeding plans and kind of help the landowners map out where it might be best to put their CRP.
Why is this area so prone to potholes, and why is it so poorly drained?
Well, it has the most recent glacial history, the north-central part of Iowa, stretching down to Des Moines. Of course, then you've got the margins out to about Carroll and Marshalltown, stretching all the way up through Minnesota and parts of the Dakotas. It's a very young landscape. Glaciers retreated some, I think, 10, 12,000 years ago. So you've got poorly drained landscape because of the ice melt that happened so rapid, and lots of depressional areas resulted from that. Of course, we had beautiful prairies that established too, and that means we have the best soils probably here in the north central part of the state. If you're farming, this is where you want to farm. The farmers are under a lot of pressure to produce a lot of grain. We're trying to feed the world. The margins are slimmer now because of their input costs and that type of thing. So there's pressure to really produce this land that's capable of producing. It's just beautiful soil, and of course we're trying to keep it that way. We want to keep it in place. We want to keep that soil health in good shape for years to come, for many generations.
And that's where you talk about the no-till. That helps keep it in place.
Right. That's certainly one practice that's going to retain soil health. Organic matter is a big deal. We want to retain that. And one way to do it is to keep those residues in place on the surface, and they eventually work their way down into the profile. Tillage operations tend to burn more carbon, and that means organic matter. So you know, we're also trying to push some practices like cover crops to get more material on the soil surface so we can improve that soil quality. soil tilth, aggregation, bulk density, those are all big deals. It's not just about yields. We got to think about long-term productivity.
Have you talked to farmers that are worried about getting into the fields this late?
Oh, sure have. They're frustrated. They're upset by what's happened. You know, they're not wanting to see me right now, I guess, because of what's happened. Some of them are real upset about the erosion and that type of thing. They're not out there trying to abuse the ground, but we're getting so late in the season that we're going to see yield reductions, and certainly in corn. Fortunately, most of the corn is in the ground. There's not many fields that aren't planted, the corn fields, but it's definitely going to hurt come harvest time. And you know, here again, there's pressure to get big yields, and it's going to be tough.
Can you explain what you meant when you said they don't want to see you?
Well, they know what's happened out there, and they know that I'm concerned about the erosion that's gone on. And some of them feel bad about what's happened on their own fields. They don't want me to be out there looking around to draw attention to it. So by law, we have to go out and take some pictures, take photos, do an inventory of the damage events. Because we are a federal agency, this is an issue for the entire ag department from Des Moines on up to the Washington, D.C. They want to know if there's a disaster out here. They want to know if we need to declare areas a disaster because of rain events like this. Certainly, this is an opportunity to visit with people and do some conservation planning. That's kind of what we want to do. We want to try to do this on a voluntary basis so they feel good about it and want to do it.
And when you're looking for erosion, what do you look for?
I generally look for two things, what we call ephemeral erosion, which are small gullies that can be crossed with farm equipment. Those are evident. You can see a lot of those now. The other thing I look for are the small rill erosion, which are just very small gullies that appear just because of erosion down a slope, side slopes and things like that. It's pretty evident now without the crop canopy. If we get these types of rains, I'd rather have them, in June or July when there's a canopy.
And a lot of the farmers have already applied fertilizer.
Yeah, that's an issue too. I don't know how much nitrogen is left out there for the plants, the corn plants. Of course, we're hearing reports all the time in the water treatment about high nitrates and that's to be expected after rains like this, and farmers have to have nitrogen on the ground to grow corn, so.
There are other ways of getting nitrogen in the soil, for instance, by planting beans the year before.
Right. Like I mentioned, cover crops, too, can sequester nitrogen for the next year's crop, which a lot of folks are looking into, at least. But here in corn bean country, they're going to use nitrogen. There's just no getting around it. And I would hope most farmers recognize they don't need to put on as much nitrogen as what maybe they had thought 5-10 years ago. So it costs money to put fertilizer on, and it's all about the bottom line for these producers. So,
is there anything else you'd like to say?
Well, we're in a time now where, like I mentioned, there's a lot of pressure on the farmers to produce grain. And we have to just be careful how we're treating the soil and our other natural resources, our water and our soil. We have to have this soil for future generations, so we have to keep that in mind. And there are great grandkids out there that need to eat too. But I would just ask the farmers to reconsider some things if they're doing more tillage now, maybe. Try some no-till. We can make it work. There's equipment out there that can do it, and the technology's there.
And farmers will have assistance to make these changes? Technical assistance.
Technical assistance, sure. We can help out that regard, yeah. Of course, there's a lot of equipment people out there that probably know more than I do. But I like to look at that stuff myself, keep up on the equipment changes. It's something I do personally because I like to see the new types of equipment out there and how the planter adjustments and the adaptations on planters work.
Well, it sounds like a good thing to do on a rainy day.
Yeah, we've had a lot of those lately. I wish the sun would come out and it would make things a lot better.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. We're your hosts, Greta Anderson and Stephanie Schubert, and we were just talking to Dana Holland of NRCS about the soil erosion in the county that has come from these heavy rains.
Not a sunny picture.
I don't envy his job right now. Our other guest, Clay Pierce, seemed a little more cheerful about the rain.
That's because he's talking about fish.
Yeah, what they like, what they don't like.
What they're into, water.
So let's say we go back to Clay and get a different perspective.
The fish's eye view of these crazy rains.
We are here with Clay Pierce, a USGS research scientist specializing in fish. And Clay is going to talk to us about how the fish are responding to all of this rain we're having. You know, last fall and winter, the streams were just so low, and now they are up to their necks in water. How do fish respond to this kind of up and down situation?
Well, that's a great question. You know, I guess for starters, remind everybody that fish live in water, so they love rain. They got to have rain to have water, and rain is just part of our hydrological cycle. Fish are very well adapted to all kinds of variation in water. I mean, rainfall varies. It's always varied. And so the levels go up and down naturally. As you mentioned, last year was a drought year, and so in the late summer and in the fall, the water levels were very low in the rivers, and people would travel across the bridges and look at the Skunk River with just a dry sand bed and tire tracks up and down the sand bed, wonder where did the fish go. A couple miles upstream in North Ames, some of the areas in the Skunk River there had a lot of residual water, and there were fish in those places. I went out and looked a couple times myself. I was just kind of curious. And I saw fish swimming around in some of the pools. Some people that I know that fish actually caught some smallmouth bass last late summer and fall. Those guys know where to look, and they found them. Fish are very good at finding the residual water. Some of the fish probably swim downstream kind of as the water levels are slowly receding. They're sensing that there's more water downstream, and so they probably were many miles downstream in the lower portions of the South Skunk, the river that flows through here. And some of them, you know, hang out in the residual pools, but probably a lot of them did die as well. Some of them that got into a pool that just completely dried up, well, those are the unlucky ones, and that's part of the natural life cycle of these fish. They do experience fairly high mortality just for a variety of natural reasons, and some of those fish that got into pools that were smaller and smaller and smaller as the drought continued, they became food for herons, raccoons, and other other creatures that also have to eat, and so it's all part of the natural cycle. But I think your question today was more about the other side of the coin. We have the high water now, and a week ago we were concerned that Ames might experience some significant flooding. Some areas in Iowa have experienced, Marshalltown being one not far from here, experienced some pretty big flooding, and Iowa City was under the gun until just the last couple days and still not out of the woods. But fish are very good at adapting to and exploiting the high water as well as the low water. In fact, a lot of the fish do very well after a high water event. There's been lots of studies that have shown that reproduction is often very good in high water years, and that's because the high water makes a lot of habitat that would normally not be available to the fish up on the floodplain available now. There's lots of cover. There may be good spawning substrates. I've heard people talk about, you know, seeing fish spawning in the shallow water on somebody's driveway, on the gravel, or on gravel roads. And those are just little anecdotes, but just they kind of point to the fact that high water brings in a tremendously large amount of habitat that normally is not there. and so these fish can spread out. Another thing that it does is that when the young fish are hatched out, and these little baby fish now are very vulnerable to being eaten by, you know, everything that's out there. And if they have all this new habitat to spread out in, all the terrestrial grasses and, you know, the kind of vegetation that you would have in a floodplain, lots of brush, lots of underbrush, small trees, grass, even in some cases probably some crops that get flooded, well, those become very safe, protective areas for young fish to hang out. So some of the best years of reproduction have been flood years, and it's just an interesting thing that a lot of people probably don't realize.
That's really cool. Well, the rivers and streams are running really fast right now. How about the fish? Do they flow downstream with all that water, or are they going to stay put here where they're spawning?
Well, that's a great question, and people look at a flood situation. You have that very fast water, and you imagine yourself, if you fell off the bank into that water, where you would be, and none of us would be in a very good position in that case. But, you know, fish live in water, and they're very good swimmers, and they're very good at finding slower water, protected areas, cover. That's basically what they do all the time, regardless of whether it's a flood or it's just average flow conditions. There's always a tremendous amount of variation. If you just look at a stream in normal flow, or certainly in flood, it looks like all that water is going past at a more or less constant speed. But in fact, if you look at it three-dimensionally, going from top to bottom, there's a tremendous amount of variation in the speed of the current. It's fairly slow down by the bottom. It's very slow behind cover objects, and of course in a flood you have lots of trees, just lots of things that are in the water, the natural obstructions that now become cover and affect the flow, and there's a lot of places where fish can find very slow, or in fact no velocity in the water. And there are places where it's reversed. There's eddies where the water is flowing back upstream for short distances. So, you know, it looks scary, but it's if you're a fish underwater, you can find places, and that's clearly what they do. Probably some fish in really massive floods, probably some fish, some smaller fish that aren't as strong as some of the larger ones, they probably get displaced downstream a little bit. And people have studied this. You know, people have done studies where they've marked fish with some kind of a colored dye injection under their skin, or clipping their fins, or putting tags on them. It's not an easy thing to do, because you got to mark a lot of fish and then hopefully recapture some and see where they were in relation to where they were released. But those studies have shown that maybe there's some downstream displacement, but as soon as the water slows down, they start moving back upstream. We were talking about the drought situation earlier. People wonder, well, where did all those fish go and how fast will they come back? Studies that have looked at that have shown that just within a matter of days, the numbers of fish in a stream that was either dry or in some cases experimentally poisoned out so they could study the process of recolonization, they come back so quickly it just would amaze you. Another thing about floods is that the stream channel itself, the water is very fast in there, and you know, people need to be very careful about getting in streams when it's in a flood condition, because the velocities really are fast. But the water that has spilled up over the top of the stream bank and out onto the floodplain, you know, into the lawns and the parks and the parking lots and places like that, you know, you look at those waters and that's very calm. So, you know, those are places where the fish that maybe got washed out or maybe chose to swim out of the very fast moving channel, now they're up, you know, in the Hy-Vee parking lot, or hopefully not the Hilton Coliseum parking lot. But, you know, those flooded areas are very, very calm water, and the fish can just hang out there and wait until the waters recede, and they can go back in the channel.
Is there anything else you'd like to say, Clay, about this weather and the fish that you study?
Well, I don't want to leave people with the impression that it's all bad news, and, you know, floods and even the droughts. The fish we have, the smallmouth bass, and people like to fish for channel catfish around here. Even some walleyes sometimes can be had, and even some of the lesser species from the perspective of fishermen, some of the suckers and other things, and things like sunfish, Green sunfish and bluegill sunfish can be caught in the streams, and they're a lot of fun to catch. You know, they're going to be there, and they're going to be waiting for your lure or your worm or whatever you're using. Lots of fly fishermen actually have some good luck. That's kind of fun. So the high water we're having now really shouldn't discourage people, probably should encourage people that let that water come down, make it safe for wading and getting in and out of the streams and maybe doing a float trip. And fishing will probably be pretty good, you know, in a month or two.
Well, thanks a lot, Clay. Thanks for sharing your insights with us and our listening audience.
You're welcome. And get out there and enjoy our aquatic resources in Iowa. Our streams and lakes are a lot of fun and lots of fish to be caught, lots of wildlife to be viewed, and just lots of good times to be had.
How high's the water, Mama? 2 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Papa? She said it's 2 feet high and rising. But we can make it to the road in a homemade boat, 'cause that's the only thing we got left that'll float. It's already over all the wheat and oats. 2 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Mama? 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Papa? She said it's 3 feet high and rising. Well, the hives are gone, I lost my bees. Chickens are sleeping in the willow trees. Cows in water up past her knees. 3 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Mama? 4 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Papa? She said it's 4 feet high and rising. Hey, come look through the window pane. The bus is coming, gonna take us to the train. Looks like we'll be blessed with a little more rain. 4 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Mama? 5 feet high and rising. How high's the water, Papa? She said it's 5 feet high and rising. Well, the rails are washed out north of town. We gotta head for higher ground. We can't come back till the water goes down. 5 feet high and rising. Well, it's 5 feet high and rising.
You have been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Today, we have been talking about
the weather.
We spoke with John Dunn, Director of Ames Water and Pollution Control Department.
Dana Holland, District Conservationist for the Story County Soil and Water Conservation District.
And Clay Pierce, a USGS research scientist specializing in fish. Their contact information is available on our website, khoifm.org. Find the Shows tab and look under Local Talk.
Reporters who contributed to this show have been Greta Anderson and Stephanie Schubert. We are your hosts today as well.
Local Talk is engineered by Richard Morrison.
Music you heard included Buckets of Rain by Bob Dylan from Blood on the Tracks.
Glaciers by Dan Bull, who self-identifies as a geeky British rapper.
Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head by B.J. Thomas from the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Who'll Stop the Rain by Creedence Clearwater Revival.
And 5 Feet High and Rising by Johnny Cash.
Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley.
You can also listen to this show and all of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. And see listings of our past guests and resource contact information.
If you enjoyed this show, tell your friends.
Local Talk Radio is a production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you would like to join the team as a reporter, contact us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878. Or contact us through our website, khoifm.org.
Your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.